Well, even though we've got a minute or two, I'm just going to go ahead and open the Ashland Housing and Human Service Commission. And the first thing on our agenda is the approval of minutes. Before I go into this, we have 1/2 hour. And even though we just have kind of like reporty kinds of things, we're going to have to move quickly. So has everybody read the minutes in their packet?
Yes.
And Heidi, would you like to make a correction?
Yes. There are just a few, not big ones. On the first, the November 19th minutes, at the bottom of the second page, it's AmeriCorps. It was just a misprint. And on the next set of minutes, at the bottom of Brian Shelton Kelly, it says his name as Brain, and it should be Brian. More than 50% of their income on rent in number one under Ryan Haynes. It's a very small typo. And I think that's it. Other than that, if I would move to approve the minutes from...
That would be both sets of minutes?
Yes, from December 10th and November 19th.
Okay. I'll second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, raise your hand. Wave it. Any opposed? All right, good. Thanks. Hi, Chris. So the second thing on the agenda, and these are going to be really, I think, really important things for us to understand going forward this year. So we have the update on the CDBG and social service grant schedule and update. And there's a lot in there. And Linda, can you give us a quick summary of that report and where we're at? So it was in your packet, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just briefly, you know, normally the social service grant RFP would be out by now. It's generally issued as a joint application between the City of Medford, the City of Ashland, and United Way. Just due to COVID and staffing issues at like all levels, United Way is choosing not to do a joint application this year. It's only running their own application. And I don't know what the City of Medford's doing. We did not meet about it as we normally do. So that gave us the leeway to really decide when we want to do our process. It's not a codified process and it has no sort of regulatory pieces like CDBG. And then the only thing is, you know, normally we would do contracts and release funds in July of each year, sort of the new fiscal year. So just looking at, you know, your preference from years past of doing both CDBG and social service grants, I mean, I know there is not a lot of spaciousness between those processes and that really kind of gets backed up to review and make recommendations on those grants and hear presentations from applicants. So we decided that we would issue the RFP in March. So as you can see, you'll get your CDBG applications before the February meeting, but we won't have any review or recommendation until the March meeting. So we'll just issue the RFP for the social service grants in the middle of March. Those applications will be due in April. And so you will get those applications in April, and then we'll do the review and recommendation the following month in May. So we'll have plenty of time for the first time ever to really, you know, go over those applications and not have a quick turnaround time like we've had in the past. And then those recommendations will go, you know, forward to the council in June at their June meeting. And we are thinking the 15th, but honestly, if it got pushed to the next meeting, that would be fine too, because we just have a lot of time because we're doing it this way. And then their final, you know, allocation would be done in June, and then we would do contracts in July. So that's just the difference for this year than in years past. Do you guys have questions about that?
Heidi.
Are we on track to get a new member now that Gina's not with us on this commission anymore?
You know, we're actually down two members. Yeah. So Erin had to step out because she started her nursing program. And then Gina obviously got elected to council. But I think Gina is going to be our liaison, so she'll still be with us.
Can I comment here? Sure. I just got a text from Gina, and she's trying to figure out how to get in. Can you send her another email? I don't know whether she got the...
Yeah, original. I will do so. I sent her an email today from Zoom at probably around noon. But I'll go ahead and go into Zoom and click resend, and hopefully she can get it.
Thanks. So we do have two applicants. Well, we have two people who are thinking about applying. That's what I should say. They're not applicants yet, but they're thinking about applying. One is a employee of the DHS and is actually going to come and speak to us at our meeting in February to talk about resources that are available at the DHS. And then
Latino.
Yes. And then the other is a woman who, she is here. And I don't know that she understands. I mean, I guess Brandon could make us see her, but I'll say Lita, because you can hear me. That you are using the attendee link, and so we can't see you or hear you, but you can obviously hear and see us, but yeah, obviously you can post in chat. So Lita is also interested in potentially applying.
The panelists are limited to active commissioners, the people that were consultants and staff, not general attendees, that because there isn't a public forum portion of the regular meeting. I can promote her for this meeting if you guys would like, but at 4:30 we would move it back to an attendee. So it's your call.
It's up to you, Rich.
Well, I just stick her in and we'll, like she was at a meeting, and so I think that would be all right, with the understanding that we'll go back to the watch program, I guess is what we would say.
And it looks like she did send in her application. She put that in the chat. So maybe you guys can all see that. I have my chat open so I can see.
So she's in this panel now, but her microphone is off and video is off.
Thank you, Brandon. Oh, there she is.
Well, I hope.
So that's all I had, Rich, if you wanted to move on from that agenda item.
Well, I just wanted to see, are there any more comments? I think the comment that I would have is that we're going to have a full schedule in the spring. I mean, we're going to be doing also housing trust fund too, right? So,
No, that's next year. Yep, because we're doing opposite years.
Okay, so I just want to be clear. Okay, that's good, but that was in the newspaper article.
I don't know. No?
Rich?
Okay.
Rich?
Okay.
Sorry to interject, Rich, but if you're texting Gina, could you tell her to check her council email? That's where it was sent.
Well,
it was to Gina.Duquesne at...
If someone else could do that. So I have this little tiny phone here that doesn't text.
I'll give it a
Linda
shot.
Rapon can do that. Okay. Perfect.
So it's at her council.ashland.or.us email.
Okay. Then moving on to the next point, which is racial justice commitment adoption discussion. That's a long title.
That's your topic, Rich.
I think he's frozen.
What?
Oh, it's your topic. You were frozen for a minute there. Sorry.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll try to unfreeze. The city council is looking at adopting a racial equity commission. And with all the work that in the legislature and in our local communities, with the exception of perhaps the county, folks are really making an effort to look at the work that they do through a racial justice lens. That means kind of using it as an overall view of when we make decisions, we're more aware of that. And I was hoping, because we had that great goal setting meeting in December, that when we get to those goals, that we can also include a adoption of a racial justice lens, a housing equity lens to all the work that we're doing. So it's just open for discussion. We're not making a meeting now.
Rich is frozen again. I have something to say, though, if it's okay.
Go ahead, Echo.
Okay, until he's unfrozen. So I've done a little work on that topic. I found a pretty interesting PDF that has a number of examples of social justice, human rights, impact assessment templates that are used in Eugene and Seattle and Portland. And they vary. Some of them are really extensive and look like a lot of work for some poor staff person. And some of the examples are look a little bit more realistic for our workload. But if that would be appropriate, I could send that to everybody just to kind of get that ball rolling for an example of what we might actually practically do. That's it.
And Echo, if you wanted to send them to me, I can go ahead and send them out to everyone.
Okay.
And maybe, okay. Rich, do you want to put it on? I mean, we can look at it maybe at an upcoming meeting to discuss maybe which template or what parts we like or how we want to.
Yeah. It's really kind of a heuristic device, I think, at this point. An example of the kinds of questions, the kinds of data that need to be gathered and then considering what's realistic, you know, for our capacity.
Yes.
Heidi.
I'd just like to remind commissioners that according to public meeting laws, rules, we're not supposed to send anything to fellow commissioners unless we're communicating with one other. But we need to go through our staff person and she can send things out.
And that's why I waited to bring it up here, because I knew that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that Racial Justice Commission at the city does have housing on their list of mission to work on racial justice and housing. And so I think they've got such a big thing that we could help a little bit with that work. So the next part is a quick update on, but it's really extensive, on where we are on the COVID homelessness response. And Linda, you want to, and others can chime in on that, of where we're at with funding for our unhoused folks right now in Ashland.
So I'm going to have to go back a little bit, Rich. Sorry, I know we're kind of hurrying, but I wanted to mention just on the racial justice and housing piece that many of you know, because I sent out an email, that we now have a Southern Oregon Fair Housing Council staff person who's here who can do training and also is here as a resource for if you have people experiencing discrimination or having questions about issues of discrimination, you can actually send them to her and she will answer the phone and talk to them. So it's really exciting. She's also convening regular meetings of stakeholders in the Southern Oregon region to talk about upcoming issues and trainings and resource needs. So that's a resource that we don't always have at our disposal. And I think that's going to be really valuable moving forward as we have these discussions and we address fair housing issues. Anyway,
I heard this afternoon that one of Biden's executive orders allows.
Man, you're frozen. Been there, and it helps though.
Fair housing work.
There he goes.
I heard that too. So I think that there'll be some assistance. So anyway, I'll just jump into the next thing. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, so I don't want to go too far into it just because we're short on time. We've talked about a lot of what we've funded with the CDBG CV funding that we received, the additional CDBG allocation, you know, the meals, the shower truck, the non-congregate sheltering in hotels. And then, you know, more recently with the Affordable Housing Trust Fund money, there's been additional hotel housing through Maslow Project for families with children. And then the continuation of some hotel funding with ORA for vulnerable populations, and then mostly ORA with the winter shelter. And then, you know, early on, we had talked about how to address non-congregate sheltering for the inclement weather shelter. And out of that came that whole pallet shelter with the partnership with the Unitarian Church. And those are still moving forward. We actually just got the green tag for the electrical, I think yesterday or 2 days ago, and we got the utility account set up today. And so we're that much closer to being able to get people in there. So members of the Unitarian Church and ORA and I are scheduling a meeting for early next week to go over the final documents, just because this is a very new activity for all three of us, and we need to have some policies and procedures on how we'll you know, identify populations to be placed into that housing. And then, because it's not the car park program, you know, what are the, it's more like a leasing or an occupancy agreement. So sort of what are the requirements for that, and how will we address, you know, how it's different. Like, they'll be able to have pets and they don't have to leave during the day. So there's a bunch of different things like that. So we're working on those, and we're all getting together next week to finalize those documents and hopefully get something in place. We still are looking for someone to come by as a volunteer, so a group of people on a rotating basis to just check in on the people who are in the pallet houses. So instead of having an actual oversight plan, what our plan is essentially is someone to come, you know, knock on the door in the evening and just check in on people and make sure, you know, that everything is okay. And then potentially, you know, we might start out with like 4 or 5 days a week to begin with, and then go down to like 2 days a week as people get settled in. So that's kind of the thought process we're having around that. And then the other thing is, you know, that pallet shelter idea came out of a much larger idea, which was sort of copying the urban campground that Rogue Retreat was able to open in Medford. That effort is pretty extensive and costly. And so that was something that we, you know, just, we didn't have the funding to do at the time. But there was some funding made available through the state of Oregon through the Emergency Solutions Grant coronavirus allocation that was given to Oregon Housing and Community Services. And then through that organization, put out through a request for proposals process to anyone within the state with specific allocations for each county. So the Jackson County got a specific allocation of that funding because we were impacted by the wildfires. And then we were supposed to coordinate with our continuum of care on an application for that funding. So the city did coordinate with the continuum of care and with Rogue Retreat around, you know, what would we need in order to do something like this. We did just choose a 5-month window, feeling like, you know, who knows what things will be like in 5 months, and that this was really our emergency response plan that we had hoped we could start, you know, in November, but the funding timeline just didn't align well with that. And so Rogue Retreat graciously agreed to partner with us on this should we receive the funding. And so we did submit an application for $300,000. We don't know whether we will receive all of that funding or a portion of it or any of it at all, but we should find out in mid-February, which was the timeline given in the grant application. And then at that time, I would have a further update. And then lastly, just the inclement weather shelter is probably the only thing I have to update people about. And essentially what that effort has been is that at the beginning of the year, along with the discussion around the campground, it was how will we address our inclement weather shelter needs in the past, we've had Southern Oregon Jobs for Justice, who essentially took that, took the role of organizing that shelter, in the sense that they would find a location and then they would schedule volunteers to staff the shelter. And most of the time, at least one of those volunteers would be either Jason or Vanessa or both of them. And so this year they just said they didn't have the capacity to undertake this and to take this responsibility on with the other things they had going on in their lives. But they were gracious enough to provide me with a contact person who could organize the volunteers who were willing to stay at the inclement weather shelter from people who had done it in the past. And so I have coordinated with that volunteer coordinator, whose name is Joy, and then also continue to work with Jason and Vanessa to find locations. So the protocol is that I just watch the weather, and then I check in with Adam and I check in with Joy around volunteers, and then we sort of see if we can find a location. The location can be very difficult, and since COVID, some of the locations that we've been able to use in the past are not available anymore. And so that has been a challenge. We did come to an agreement with the Bellevue Grange that we could rent that space overnight with, you know, fairly short notice. And so that is available for us if we need it. But the city is paying for that, and we have to pay for it out of affordable housing trust funds because we don't have any other money to pay for it, any unrestricted funds. And we really, we don't have a lot of that to pay for this purpose. I know that there has been some pushback in the community that they wish that we could have it open all the time. But that to me is, you know, not entirely up to the city. I mean, there are budgetary implications to having to pay for a space for a long time. And then, you know, the volunteer staffing is another huge piece. And as Heidi well knows, I mean, you can run it for a few days, or like in this instance, they were able to staff it for, I think, what is it, going on 4 or 5 days. But if we had to do that all the time, we would quickly burn out the group of volunteers, and we just wouldn't have the capacity. So we try to be judicious for when we call the shelter, and we really check in to make sure that we have volunteer coverage before we go ahead and put that news item out there. But that's the process we've been using, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you guys have about any of that. Jackie?
I just have a happy update that I'd like to give, I'll make it short if I could. I can wait till after questions to you, though, Linda.
Go ahead.
Well, so I just talked with Michelle Arellano, director of ORA, and we got very exciting news that the Project Turnkey Advisory Committee did give ORA the yes vote for buying a hotel. And on Monday, that's the first hurdle, though. Now, the big hurdle on the votes. Now, on Monday, the Oregon Community Foundation Board will need to vote. But of course, they needed that yes from Project Turnkey. So on Monday. And then I just want to prepare you for the deluge of press releases that will be coming out. You're going to see, if it all goes like we hope, you're going to see it in the Tidings and the Mail Tribune. And we're going to be in paired with the Oregon Community Foundation. So we want the same message to come out to everyone. And it just kind of makes me cry because we've worked really hard on this. So give us lots of good hope over the weekend that that she'll get to hear about it.
Yeah. I had wanted to say something quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Gina.
So I just wanted to say something quickly. Congratulations, Aura, right on. I'm so excited about that. And just to kind of go back a little bit, Linda, how you touched on the $300,000 funding, that I'm very optimistic that we're going to get that too. The lot, fingers crossed. And just to put a word out there is that the council being proactive, something that we want to do is when we do get that funding in mid-February, we are ready to hit the ground running. So we are looking at surplus property, whereas Linda can get the funding, you get it, great, but where are we going to locate everybody? So we are looking at properties now so that we can roll it out. We'll have everything in order. So
Woohoo!
Okay, if I can get us back on the agenda, we got Chris coming in. He's going to give us a summary report of what's happening at SOU, a goal that we've been working on for some time. And then the very last thing will just be setting the agenda or just talking about the agenda for the next meeting. And we have about 6 minutes.
All right. I'll try to be really quick then. So the latest update is that we had our first housing roundtable discussion today here at SOU. So we actually got a lot of students who really want to be involved and part of the process and understanding more about Ashland and maybe what they can do for the community. So Linda mentioned earlier that, you know, sometimes the trouble might be that we just don't have enough volunteers. So, you know, I would like for all of us to maybe consider the idea of actually having a better partnership with SOU in terms of internships on how we can utilize our own community members here in Ashland on ways that we can get them more involved in the community on some level. So I've been trying to, right now I'm trying to take an inventory on what we're doing here at SOU, and then also trying to take an inventory of what are the organizations doing as far as, you know, are they using SOU students or not? And it's something that we should probably also consider when we're talking to our applicants and asking them, you know, are they using students? Is that something that they may consider doing in the future? Because I just see a huge opportunity on how we can somehow bridge our SOU students to be a part of this initiative. So that's what I wanted to kind of just get out there. We can talk more about this in a different month, but I want to just kind of bring that on the table to get some feedback and some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's terrific. Heidi, go ahead.
I don't want to rain on your parade or anything, but over the last 10 years, I have met with countless numbers of SOU students and gone through background checks. They've signed up and then never appear. Or they email me at the last minute and say, I have a test tomorrow, I can't come. I think we've only successfully had one SOU student in the 10 years I was doing the shelters that actually ended up being a responsible volunteer. So it's a great idea. And in the beginning, I thought, wow, that's a great resource. But the reality is it didn't work. So,
Heidi, I supervised practicum students for over 20 years at SOU. You're right. Chris and I had a long chat about the whole larger issue at SOU around internships. And what you just said is what I talked to him about yesterday, that there's often a disconnect between what people in the community think SOU students can do, will do, and what actually happens. And so there has to be really great vetting and the criminal background checks you mentioned in many cases and supervision on the SOU side. And that means SOU's got to get serious about it. And because I just wanted your frustrations, I completely understand.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And Linda.
I would just say I do need some people to check on the pallet shelter people. And my thought is that it seems more successful if they're getting some sort of credit or internship hours, or, I mean, if you tie it to that, that's a really good way to go, because then they have to do it for a grade.
Well, we're almost to the end of our meeting. Linda, we have our next meeting coming up on the February 25th. Do you need suggestions about agenda items? Or
I think we're pretty full. We have our DHS guy coming to do the resources. We have potentially this discussion of the fair housing racial justice issue. And then we also have our debrief and strategizing around the priorities from the December meeting. So I think we're probably pretty good for agenda items, unless someone has something really pressing.
I think we're ready to go. We've got 2 minutes before we're scheduled. Is everybody there? Is everybody in the Zoom meeting now that we're going to have? Not yet.
No, there's still planning commissioners and planning staff.
Okay.
That are expected, and they'll probably be here within a minute. Okay.
I noticed, Brandon, that we were having a little bit of trouble. Doesn't it help when everybody mutes and we might not get as much freezing?
Yeah, I think it's highly dependent on the user's Wi-Fi connection. So I did notice that you were freezing, but I wasn't seeing others freeze. So if you are able to turn off your video or your audio, if you're not using it, it is a way to secure some bandwidth for you. And I will also say that this is going to be probably the largest Zoom meeting of commissions that I've been a participant in. I think we have 24 individuals, and unless you have a big computer screen, our faces might be quite small. I use the gallery view so I can see everybody at once, but in the upper right-hand corner, there is a choice between gallery view and speaker view, if you're not familiar. And using the speaker view might be a way to see the consultant or staff or questioners more closely when they ask questions.
Well, it's 4:30, so I'll welcome our comrades from the Planning Commission into this joint mission of the Planning and Housing Commission, Housing and Human Services. And our purpose is to get a update from Econ Northwest on their drafts of housing needs and program. So in what I'm going to do is turn all of that over to Brandon, who can introduce the people and basically work with us all to make sure that we're part of this discussion.
Well, thank you, Rich. I did want to start, obviously, by welcoming you, as well as welcoming our consultants. Sadie DiNatelli and Beth Goodman are with us, and they're from Eco Northwest and have been working on the housing capacity analysis. But before we get into the actual meat of the agenda item, I wanted to give you a little background in terms of what a housing capacity analysis is. Essentially, the state passed in 2019 House Bill 2003, which required all communities over 10,000 to do a housing needs analysis or a housing capacity analysis. Ashland is fortunate in that we just completed our buildable lands inventory in 2019, and so that showed pretty clearly what the supply of land was in different residential zones. And so the housing capacity analysis is really a technical document that's intended to identify issues with residential land use and unmet housing needs. And so it is intended to meet specific requirements within the Oregon administrative rules. And it involves really three major components. The first being what I just mentioned, a buildable lands inventory, where cities look at all land within the urban growth boundary and ensure that we can accommodate residential, employment, and other land needs for the next 20 years. The scope of this project, the housing capacity analysis, is 2021 through 2041. So when we get into the presentation of numbers and how much land and how many housing units will be expected, it's really the 2041 period that we're planning for under this housing capacity analysis. And the housing capacity analysis really identifies what the needs are. It's based on the official population that's provided by Portland State University for the city of Ashland, as they are, again, under state law, provide the population estimates for all communities within the state. And so using that growth rate of where Ashland expects to be in terms of population at 2041, plus looking at economic information in terms of household income levels, and the mix of housing needs that would be needed to support that future growth, comparing the capacity of the current residential buildable lands in the urban growth boundary with that identified residential land need is really what the intent of the housing capacity analysis is as a technical document. And then we get to the third component, which is really housing strategies. And also as part of House Bill 2003, within a year of completing a housing capacity analysis, cities should complete a housing production strategy. In order to get a jump start on that, using this process to look at housing strategies will help us identify really the how to address identified housing needs. And so the strategies ultimately will recommend policies intended to meet how we can accommodate housing choice for all of Ashland's residents going forward. What this gets to is there'll likely be recommendations in terms of if there is identified need for instance, high density multifamily, policies that could amend existing policies within the comprehensive plans, housing element or land use standards or funding mechanisms could be put forth for consideration by the city council. And before turning it over to Beth, who I know is anxious to start the presentation component, I did want to acknowledge that the as part of House Bill 2003, when the Oregon legislature required cities to complete a housing capacity analysis, they also appropriated funding to the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development for the purposes of providing technical assistance to communities like ours. Specifically with communities that have a severe rent burden of their population. And Ashland has 34% of our renter population experiences severe rent burden. And so we qualified for that funding assistance, and DLCD did provide a grant, which is funding the work that Eco Northwest is doing. And so it's through that partnership with DLCD, Eco Northwest, and the city of Ashland that we're able to update the housing needs projections and address the housing needs of our community. So with that, let me introduce Beth Goodman and turn it over to her. And thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. Before we get started, I'd like to reconfirm with Brandon because I've forgotten already. How do you want to handle questions?
Sure, so I think that the, you know, there are quite a bit of people in participating in this Zoom meeting. However, the intent of this meeting is really to bring both commissions up to speed and give you an opportunity to have clarification questions as well as suggestions as we move down. So I would suggest that if you have a clarification question during the presentation, to either physically raise your hand or use the raise hand icon on the lower part of the Zoom, and that way Beth will identify who it is that needs to have a question answered and can call on that individual commissioner. So again, there are going to be a few steps throughout the presentation where after she gives some information, we'll stop and ask for if there are any questions on that. But again, if you have a question that's for clarification along the way, don't hesitate to interject.
Thank you, Brandon. And I'll try to keep an eye on all of you. But if I miss somebody who's got their hand up, I trust Brandon will help me with that. So thank you very much for having me here. I'm obviously Beth Goodman. I'm a project director with Echo Northwest, and I've worked with dozens of cities across Oregon to develop what are now called housing capacity analysis. They used to be called housing needs analysis. So if I slip in my language, they're synonymous with each other. My colleague here, Sadie DiNatale, has worked with me on a number of housing capacity analysis projects, and we're working together with Medford and also with Tualatin to develop two of the first housing production strategies. So we'll be bringing what we're learning to that about that process to some of the advice we're providing Ashland with. So with that, what I'd like to do is start a PowerPoint, and I want to make sure that as we're going through this, if you have questions or comments,
about each piece. Make sure that you feel okay to speak up, because that'll be important to make sure that you are understanding what we're doing. So the first question you might have is, why does any city do a housing capacity analysis, and why is Ashland doing it? So at the most basic level, what Ashland's trying to do and what any city in Oregon are trying to do is answer the question, do we have enough land to accommodate growth of population and housing over the next 20 years? You can see that that's a complex question, and you can break it out quite a bit, looking at buildable land, which we'll do in a few minutes, and then looking at development of different housing types, which we'll also talk about. And then I think even more interestingly, maybe not more importantly, but what policies does Ashland need to meet the housing needs in the community? So these are all the types of questions we'll be answering in this project. As Brandon said, there's a lot of administrative rules and statutes, as well as legal cases, that are behind how we do a housing needs analysis. We try not to expose you to too many of those because you might get bored and fall asleep on us. But this is one of the important ones. When we talk about needed housing, that has a very specific meaning in the Oregon statutes. So needed housing is housing that includes, but isn't limited to, attached single family housing, so that's townhouses, detached single family housing, and multifamily housing, both for owner and renter occupancy. Those are the main types of housing that we focus on here, but we also have to consider need for government assisted housing, since Ashland doesn't regulate that differently from other housing types. We don't forecast a specific need, but there is need for government-assisted subsidized housing. Mobile and manufactured dwelling units, both in parks and on individual lots. Oregon requires that all cities plan for manufactured home parks and allow these types of housing on individual lots. And then housing for farm workers, which, since Ashland is an urban area, housing for farm workers looks a lot like housing for other populations. So as we're talking about housing need and as we're talking about housing types, we focus a lot on these types of housing as we go along. You might wonder, what are we going to get out of this project? So the two pieces that are in blue, above our dotted line, there's a technical report that's a housing capacity analysis, and it has all of the information that you see on the screen there about buildable lands inventory and housing market, et cetera. It concludes with an analysis of, do we have enough land, enough capacity for new housing to accommodate our forecast? And we'll be taking you all the way through that analysis today. And then there's a separate document, a housing strategy. And we'll be writing your housing strategy around strategic issues like land availability, land serviceability, or land that needs services rather, types of housing that are needed, housing affordability, infrastructure, and funding. And as we're writing your housing strategy, we'll be thinking about how a housing production strategy comes together so that it's a little bit easier for you to draw information out of these documents into your housing production strategy. The important point here is that work doesn't end when we're done with this project. When we're done with this project, you may have comprehensive plan amendments that need to be made. You may have changes to your zoning code. You may have new policies or programs that aren't addressed through the comprehensive plan that need to be put in place. So what you can think of some of this from the housing strategy and then later the housing production strategy is a work plan for your planning staff for over the next 8 years. So what are the things that the city needs to do to meet its housing need over the next 8 years? And I say 8 years specifically because Ashland will be required 8 years from now to conduct a new housing needs analysis and to develop a new housing capacity analysis. And that requirement is part of House Bill 2003. So with all of that, before I go on talking about other technical information, are there any questions? Jackie, it looks like you have one.
It's small, but I heard you say that Ashland, since Ashland is urban, and I have often heard that Ashland is in the category of rural. So can you just explain that?
Well, that's a way of thinking about it from a planner. Okay. Ashland has an urban growth boundary.
Right.
And so you're not farm and forest land. You're land that is designed to develop at some urban densities. Your urban densities aren't Portland densities, but they're okay.
And I can probably clarify that, Jackie, when you've heard that Ashland is defined as rural, that likely is through the U.S. Department of Agriculture for a community of less than 25,000, which makes Ashland eligible for USDA funds and so forth. So that might be why it's come up to the Housing Commission in the past as a rural designation.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay. So I'm going to take us through the buildable lands inventory to start with, and then an overview of the complete analysis and discussion of key assumptions. Starting with the buildable lands inventory, which when we talk about the BLI, that's what we're talking about, the buildable lands inventory. So Ashland staff developed this in 2019, and it was adopted. And this is where we've started in this analysis. So we looked at all land within the Ashland Urban Growth Boundary, UGB, where housing is allowed. So that's residential land and some types of commercial land. We took constraints into account, and the kinds of constraints that were taken into account in the buildable lands inventory includes slopes in excess of 35% in slope. Land within the floodway or floodplain was considered unbuildable. And land within resource protection areas, all three of those were considered unbuildable. So even if it was vacant, but it was within one of those areas, it was not considered as available for development. And in the end, the city identified land that was vacant, partially vacant, and potentially redevelopable. Vacant land's pretty clear. That's land with no significant development on it. Partially vacant land is a little bit less clear, but that's land with development on it where you could do additional development. So imagine a 5-acre piece of land where you've got one unit built on it. You could do additional development there within your zoning code as long as more housing was allowed in that zone. And going on to look at the map so you know what we're looking at. We see the vacant and the partially vacant and then some other types of land on this map. This is the 2019 buildable lands inventory map. So what we did is we worked with city staff to update that information from mid-2019 to mid-2020 so that we took out land that was built, had been built more recently. And this is the analysis of buildable land. So here are all your residential plan designations and your commercial and other plan designations that allow housing. And essentially we're looking at 642 acres of land. When Ashland staff estimated the capacity of housing on those lands, it was about 2,700 units of capacity in 2020. In 2019, it was about 2,800 units of capacity. So you can see there was a little bit of change, but nothing drastic, which is what I would expect over the difference in a year. So we're essentially working with the city's buildable lands inventory, just updating it a tad. So then going on to the discussion of demand for housing and housing need, we're going to present a little bit of information here about this. But there's many, many, many pages more of information that you'll have in your housing needs and housing capacity analysis document. So this is just a little bit of a sample. So again, the types of housing we're talking about are single family detached, which includes things like manufactured and mobile homes, also includes cottage housing, single family attached, so townhouses, Multifamily, we've divided this into structures with 2 to 4 units, so duplexes and quadplexes and such. And then multifamily structures with 5 or more units per structure or per building. So these are the kinds of housing we're talking about. When we look at some census data about existing mix of housing in Ashland, what we see is that 66% of Ashland's housing is single family detached. That hasn't changed a lot since 2000. 14% of Ashland's housing is multifamily with 5 or more units.
Beth, it looks like we have a question.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, my name's Lisa and I'm on the Planning Commission. I just have a definition question. What's the difference between attached single family and duplex?
That's a good question. And so I'm just going to hop back here. So in a duplex, both of these units are on one lot. And in a townhouse, you'll have each unit, there's a lot line, even though the units are adjoined to each other. So you've got separate lots.
So single family attached is the same as townhouses?
It's townhouses.
Okay.
Could be row houses also, but same thing.
Thank you.
Certainly. Are there any other questions? Okay. And Lisa, you might want to put your hand down so that you have another question.
Not yet.
I like to have them keep them coming. So what we really just see over this time period is what we see across Oregon, which was a lot of construction of single family housing as new housing types. Looking at tenure, which is ownership status, 54% of Ashland's households are owner occupied and 46% are renter occupied. That's what we typically see in a city with a university. So in Eugene, it's more like 50-50 or even sometimes 48% are owner occupied. So I would attribute part of this split in tenure to the fact that you have a university and a student population. Typically across Oregon for a lot of cities, especially smaller cities, you'll see owner occupied being around 60%, maybe 65% of units. Then when we look at the tenure of units, the type of unit by tenure, obviously most of Ashland's owner occupied housing is single family detached, but you've got a fair bit of single family attached and even a little bit of multifamily with 5 or more units, which just isn't common outside of the Portland region for smaller cities, but I think it reflects the kind of city that Ashland is. And then when you look at renter occupied units, it's a mixture really of single family and multifamily type units, which is what we'd expect. So as we're thinking about future housing need, we think about what factors affect housing demand. So we've got a graphic here that's a very stereotypical graphic of the life cycle of housing that an individual or a family would go through. The point on this graphic is that the primary factors that affect housing need are the age of the householder, and the age affects the household composition. So as people get a little bit older and out on their own, some people have children, their household composition gets bigger, their housing needs change. And then also the income. And income tends to increase until retirement age, at which case it decreases, as does household composition, as does the number of people in the household. So a person's housing needs change across their lives in pretty predictable ways on average. So we look at the data specifically about age, household composition, and income. So when we look at the existing age distribution in Ashland, what we see is what we see in a lot of places, but in a more exaggerated way. Ashland has an older population. 31% of its population is over age 60. That's grown quite a bit from 2000. It's a little more exaggerated in Ashland than it is in other places, but this fits with the long story I've heard about Ashland over the decades, that you attract more retirees. When we look at expected growth in population and growth in population by age for Jackson County, we're expecting faster growth in people 60 years old and older than in any other age group. And that's true across the state and across the nation. So then when we look at household composition and household size, Ashland's composition and size are different than what you see on average in Jackson County. So there's a smaller percentage of households that have families with children when compared to the county or the state, and a larger percentage of non-family households. Now, a non-family household in this case could be a single person household. It could also be two or more people who are living together who aren't related by marriage or blood. And so I imagine that that's combined with a fair number of people who are single person households, as we see here in the household size, as well as people who are living together, either because they're students and can't afford to live on their own, or because they have other reasons to live together, whether it be economic or other reasons. So when we look at household size, we see that Ashland has a smaller share of households with three or more people and a larger share of one-person households. One of the things that we've had discussed in the housing needs analysis essentially is the question is our past our future? Just because we've been an older community with smaller households and fewer households of children, does that mean that's what we have to be in the future? And I would say the answer is no, but changing some of these, given the overall demographic shifts in our nation, and given the type of market that Ashland is, in other words, you guys play a unique role in the Rogue Valley's housing market. You and Jacksonville together, you're like two little sons around the region in terms of housing prices. So you're a really nice community to live in, and you're an expensive community. That's going to make changing the past and changing your demographics difficult in the future. And we'll talk about that some when we get to talking about policy. And then household income, Ashland's household income on average, and this is median household income, is about $50,000, which is comparable with Jackson County. Jackson County is in general lower than Oregon on average. What Ashland has is a little bit larger share of households in this $100,000 plus compared to the county, and a little bit larger share of the less than $25,000. The less than $25,000, I certainly think, reflects your student population, those who do live in Ashland. What this doesn't show is accumulated wealth. There's no good source of data about accumulated wealth. And so since I've been in Oregon for a couple of decades, I've heard the story of Californians selling their very expensive house in Oregon and coming to Oregon and buying two houses because they're so cheap here comparatively. So we're not seeing accumulated wealth, and we know that that plays a role in Ashland's housing market as well as really the entire state. But we can't get to that because there's no good information. So before I go on to sales price and start yammering on some more, do you guys have any questions about what I've said so far or any comments? Okay, then I'll just continue on. So median sales price in Ashland between August and October of 2020, we are looking at $434,000 as a median sales price. Jacksonville's got you beat by just a tad bit. You're consistently very different from the rest of the region in terms of sales price, more than $130,000 above. And I think when we look at, let me see if I've got a note here. Nope. When we look at change in price over time, which we'll present in the housing needs housing capacity analysis document, you'll see that housing prices have escalated pretty quickly over the last few years. So then when we look at median gross rent, and gross rent is rent that includes certain utilities, what we see is Ashland's looking at an average or median of about $1,000 a month in gross rent. Well, this data, we know it's lagging data because it was collected between 2014 and 2018. So that's the best available data from the census, but we know that that reflects older rents. And so we looked at some existing real estate reports, and we're finding two-bedroom apartments from about $1,100 to about $1,500, and three-bedroom apartments from about $1,600 to nearly $2,000 a month in rent. So as we're thinking about rent costs, we need to keep in mind that rents are above what the census reports for the median gross rent. But what you can see here is Ashland rents are generally above all of the other cities, except bafflingly Eagle Point. It may well be that Eagle Point has such a small rental market that there's, you know, an interesting result there. I don't know. I haven't worked in Eagle Point specifically, but that surprised me. So when you combine information about incomes and housing prices, then you start looking at what's called cost burden. You're probably very familiar with cost burden, but a household said to be cost burden if they spend 30% or more of their gross income on housing costs. So in Ashland, that would be 46% of households are cost burdened, and 24% of households are severely cost burdened. And severe cost burden is when you spend 50% or more of your income on housing costs. Looking at renters, 63% of renters are cost burdened. We've got the data about severe cost burden in renters. I believe that it was right where Brandon mentioned around 34% of renters were severely cost burdened. And then cost burden is lower for owners at 31% of households. So we're looking at a significant proportion of your households, especially your renters, which make up nearly half of the households in Ashland. They're in pain. They're paying a lot of their income for housing costs. And a lot of them are paying way more than they can afford. So as we talk about income and housing costs, one way to look at housing costs is to look at this across the region at median household income, median family income, rather, I apologize. So in Jackson County, median family income is $65,000. It's a little bit different than median household income. And when we talk about low-income households, so households who can afford without being cost burdened, who can't afford market rate rents, you're talking about households with income of 50% of MFI or lower, so income of about $32,000 or less. What they can afford in terms of rent without being cost burdened is $820 a month in rent. And that includes some utilities like electricity and heat. So when we were looking at the asking rents we were finding for a two-bedroom unit, it's about $1,100 to about $1,500 a month. That's significantly higher than people who earn 50% of median family income. You have to earn about 80% of median family income, somewhere between probably 70 and 80% of median family income to really begin to afford those rents. And then when you look at median sales price, your median sales price are affordable at well above 120% median family income, at 167% of median family income. You don't have a lot of households who can afford that without being cost burdened. And so this information describes your different segments of your housing market. So as we're talking about government subsidized income restricted affordable housing, we're talking about households with income in this area. As we're talking about middle income housing, we're generally talking about households above 50%, maybe up to 120% of median family income. but often between 80 and 120% or 60 and 120%. So this is naturally occurring affordable housing. You might've heard it referred to as NOAA or middle income housing. And this is government subsidized, income restricted, low income housing. I've got so many words for that. All right, I think the next slide is about the forecast for new housing. But before I go there, we've just gone through a lot of information. Does anybody have any questions about this? Roger, it looks like you do.
When you're talking about the household burden and income like that, is that straight rent or are you doing it like with rent plus a percentage for utilities?
It includes, we're not actually calculating this. The census calculates this because they get the real data. So it includes rent plus certain utilities. Electricity and heat.
Yeah, just like FHA, thanks.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true for owner-occupied housing. It's mortgage plus interest and taxes. Interest isn't the right word, property taxes.
Right, thank you.
This is Rich. I just want to say these are really interesting statistics. They do sort of represent what most people feel is going on in Ashland. I don't see anything that's laid out, anything that is dramatically different than what people understand about our community. We don't have enough affordable rental units. We have too many single family houses. We don't have enough rent for families with children, and we lose children all the time. I guess what I'm wondering is, as we go forward, are we going to be able to see programs and ways? I mean, I would say this is a housing crisis.
I would agree with you.
And so are we going to be able to see a way forward in this that is addressing that crisis kind of issue?
Yes, but not enough. Or not maybe, enough. But okay. Not enough. So going forward, we're talking about growth of a small amount, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So you can't fix a big problem with a little bit of growth. And then the maybe part of that is it really depends on what the community is willing and able to do. So there's going to be regulatory things that we'll talk about around zoning, that kind of thing. There'll be affordable housing policies and programs that we could be talking about. And those generally come down to where are we going to get the money for it? That's a very hard question. So we'll be proposing things. And it's not the job of the consultant to decide what's right for the city, but to tell you what some of the best practices are. So Lisa, I see your hand up.
Yes, I just wanted to know if we're going to get a copy of these slides.
Brandon? Yeah.
We have a project webpage at ashland.or.us/HCA2021. Okay. And I'll put a link in the chat in a moment. And on that webpage, we're including all the packet materials for all of the meetings that have occurred as well as will occur between now and the end of this project. So this presentation will be included there, but I'm also happy to send a link to it to all the commissioners as well.
Okay. I noticed that these specific slides are not in the packet that right. We got already. So, but they're very interesting.
Yeah. And it's a matter of preparation of packet versus preparation of presentation. Are often
not a problem. Not a problem.
Yeah. Pardon me. I'm just going to move that packet over so I can open it up a little later. Were there any other questions? Okay. So then the forecast for new housing. As Brandon mentioned, we start with change in people. So that's the forecast of new people in Ashland. This forecast was prepared by Portland State University, and we extrapolated it out to 2021 and 2041 based on the methods that they require. When we look at all the requirements in a housing needs analysis using this particular forecast is sort of requirement number one, where we just don't have an option to use anything else. So we look at that. We look at population and group quarters, and we set group quarters aside because they're a little different. We look at your existing average household size, and we divide this number of people in households by the household size and get the number of new occupied units. And then we look at what the census reports for your vacancy rate. And I'm betting each of you are looking at that and going, 8.2%, that's wrong. I believe that you are correct. But let's say the vacancy rate was 1%. You don't want to plan going forward to have a housing market that's fundamentally sick. And a 1% vacancy rate shows a housing market that's just not functioning well. So using what the census says, one, there's a way we can use it and nobody really questions it because it's, you're allowed by state law to use it. And two, you can think of it as adding a little bit more housing to our forecast to provide a little bit of lubrication in the market. So this is true that this is not actually your current vacancy rate, but it's what the census reports for the 2014 to 18 period.
If I could interject a little bit on that, Beth, it can also be qualified that it's not necessarily the vacancy rate of available rental units that are in the market. That vacancy rate would also include second homes that people have that are currently vacant and are not a primary occupancy, or units that are on the market for sale but aren't occupied. So there are other types of housing that is not a primary dwelling that are included in that vacancy rate through the census calculation.
And so we're essentially adding 65 more units to your forecast to get a forecast of 858 new units of housing. So just as a note, the vacancy rate does exclude units that are vacant for seasonal, recreational, or occasional use, which may not include 100% of second homes, but likely includes a big chunk of them. So we took those out before we got to the 8.2%. So as we're planning, we're looking at 858 new dwelling units. So as we look at those 858 new dwelling units, we look at your existing distribution of housing by the income levels. These are the same income levels that we had here. So currently 19% of your households are extremely low income. They have less than 30% of median family income or less than $19,000 in household income. 37% of your households have income above 120% or $78,000 or more. So we're assuming that your distribution of income by households by income doesn't change. We're not trying to forecast future income, in part because that's very difficult to do. And the economists here at my firm certainly don't do it if they can avoid it. Because the challenges are so great and the forecast is so potentially poor. And so what this is really telling us is there is housing need here at this low income and at this middle income. And there is housing need in the future at this higher income. But remember that newly built, median household, median sales prices aren't affordable to all people in this income bracket, the highest. Your sales prices are high enough that it takes 167% of median family income to afford them. So that's simply a reminder. And then when we look at the information that we just went through, so residents age 60 and older have grown by quite a bit in the last two decades. 53% of your households are non-family households and 75% of your households have one or two person. Your median household income is a little bit lower than Oregon's median, and you have some of the highest housing costs in the region and thus fairly high cost burden. And so our conclusion is that when we're looking at new types of housing, that you need a variety of new types of housing. It's not just single family housing that you need in the future. It's things like cottage housing, which you guys are getting some good cottage housing. Things like duplexes, townhouses, multifamily housing this is a two-story multifamily housing, mixed use, which frankly, your mixed use housing looks a lot nicer than that. More like three or four story multifamily units. We're not talking about ginormous multifamily housing for here. You guys aren't Portland. But as we talk about multifamily, there'll be some questions we want to discuss with you about zoning restrictions on multifamily and what would be right for the Ashland community. That's not for today's conversation though. So then we have to forecast the mix of new housing. So that 858 new units, what kind of mix is it going to be? And these are the housing types we've just talked about: single family, detached, attached, quad and duplex, and multifamily. So here we started off looking at the housing mix from your 2012 housing needs analysis, which didn't divide out housing in quite the same way as we are here. So all single family housing, including single family attached, was included here, and multifamily housing included duplexes and tries there. We're dividing out duplexes and tries at this point in quadplexes, in part because House Bill 2001 requires cities smaller than between 10,000 and 25,000 to allow duplexes where you allow single family housing, and cities above 25,000, which obviously Ashland is not, to allow more types of middle income housing in more places. So scenario one essentially is very similar to the housing mix from 2012. Where we're looking at 40% of new housing being single family detached, little growth in single family attached, some growth in duplexes through quads, and then growth in multifamily. In scenario two, what we do is we assume a little more in duplexes, tries, and quads, and a little less in single family detached. And so as we look at the land capacity, based on these two scenarios, what we have to do is we have to figure out what plan designations allow different housing types. And that's something we've done behind the scenes a little bit here because it's a little bit complex, but you can see it clearly in the housing needs analysis, housing capacity analysis assumptions. So when we combine our forecasts for new housing, I'm going to start with scenario one. With the information we have about capacity of your buildable lands inventory, we'll go back here. This is the capacity of your buildable lands inventory. When we combine these and look at them together, what we've done is we've taken a bunch of low density plan designations and put them together because you've got a lot of different plan designations. And we've put together some of your commercial and employment plan designations together also to make this a little bit easier to see. So this is your capacity. So how many units could be developed on your vacant unconstrained land? This is your demand, and simply we subtract them. So if you have demand for 247 new units in low density, subtract that from 986, and you've got a surplus of 739. The only district that you're close on is your suburban residential, but your normal neighborhood and your multifamily residential play a really similar role in terms of types of housing as your suburban residential. So I'm not very worried about that. What we have heard people comment on is, but a lot of our land is outside of our city limits and it's not annexed yet. And annexation is difficult and time consuming. And so that's going to be an area that we need to talk about in terms of policies. So the other thing I'd point out is you don't have a lot of land in high density residential. The types of multifamily you can build in high density residential are structures, say, that are wood structures and obviously multi-story structures. They're less expensive to build than multifamily mixed use housing that you can build in commercial and employment areas, because the ground floor of those mixed use buildings, they have to be built to commercial standards per your building codes, estate building codes, et cetera. And so when you talk about affordability, the housing that you can build in commercial and employment areas, it's harder to make it affordable, you know, at that middle income and lower than it is housing that's built in high density. So you don't actually have a deficit of land in your high density plan designation, but you do have a fair bit of need there. Pardon me, I'm gonna quit out of a program. So when we look at scenario two, this is the one where you had a little less single family detached and more duplex through quads. What you see is essentially the same sort of result, just a little bit different numbers. You're still, you still have the same problem with your high density. So our conclusion is that in either scenario, you've got enough land to address your housing needs, but you do have problems. You do have things that need to be solved. Obviously, affordability, issues around annexation, and getting land online sooner. We'll bring back a little bit more detail about that particular subject so that we can talk about it in a more nuanced way when we're with our committee next time. So are there any observations you'd like to make or any comments you have on the mix of housing? We're going to have to pick one pretty soon. Lisa.
I have a question about, you're talking about big growth in senior housing. Mm-hmm. And but you're also talking, I think, about needing a big growth in duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, townhouses, things that have stairs in them, mm-hmm. things that are multifamily and have stairs in them. I don't think seniors like stairs. So how does that work?
So obviously, looking at things like cottage housing, they don't necessarily have to have stairs. Some single family detached housing don't have as many stairs, and some multifamily housing may well have elevators. So you call out an important thing. And you may also see more development of housing that is specific to seniors that is not quite any of these types. It would probably fit into the multifamily housing type, but it is designed more specifically for seniors.
Okay, so that's something as a planning commission, if we approve things, we need to be cognizant of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. And one of the other things I would point out is that your households, say your middle income households, as well as your lower income households, you may want to have families, so households with children, things like duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, townhouses, those are all ways to have somewhat more affordable housing than simply single family detached. And have family housing. I personally grew up in townhouses. I never lived in a single family unit until I was over 25.
Yeah.
And multifamily housing, some families, they need a 2 or 3 bedroom multifamily unit because that's what they can afford. And sometimes that'll be government subsidized income restricted housing. So if you have any guidance for us, we'd be happy to hear it. Otherwise, we can continue on. Okay. Then we're going to go on and start talking about policies. So, and you can see there'll be a group discussion here. So I'm going to ask you guys to give us some feedback, some ideas. So one of the things we want to start the conversation with is a little grounding in what is the city's role in housing development and what can the city do? So here we've got a lovely bubble diagram that shows essentially four important parts of development. You've got land, and you can say that land and public policy in here is where you have land that's serviced. So it has infrastructure like water and wastewater and transportation. You've got capital. So a developer has to have ability to have loans or some sort of equity. You've got public policy. And so public policy is things like zoning and density and design requirements. And then you've got market feasibility. And so essentially the developer has to be able to build something that the costs of building it can be essentially paid for with the rents or the market housing sales price. And so you have to be able to have a profitable project for most market rate developers. I think all market rate developers, your income restricted housing developers like your housing authority, so on and so forth. They have different sources of capital, and they have different expectations about market feasibility. And you have things in that case, like housing choice vouchers that also help fill in where the households just don't have enough income to even afford low-income housing. And so obviously, Ashland has a lot of influence on your public policy, your land, and your infrastructure. Those are things that you primarily influence, and other people have a harder time influencing those. Ashland probably has limited influence on market feasibility. Generally speaking, cities don't often play in the realm of capital, but we've seen some of that going on with the different bond measures. And so some of the policies we can talk about can influence market feasibility, such as tax exemptions. Or what are called waivers on system development charges, which aren't really waivers at all. There's something a little different than that. So keep this in mind, that these are the things that the city can do. And then thinking about how the market dynamics work. Generally speaking, new market supply is building housing up here, up above 100% of median family income. When you're looking at households of income around 80% of median family income and below, building housing that's affordable to them is going to take some sort of subsidy. The subsidy is greatest down here at your low income housing. So things like housing built by the housing authority or a nonprofit, but often housing that's in between 60 and 80% of median family income, it may be subsidized in the form of some sort of tax exemption or some other public subsidy. So you have to think about the different levels of affordability as we're talking about things. So in talking through the types of strategic issues that we'll be developing an analysis of, we've listed six of them here. So adequate supply of land that's serviced, that also implies with can be annexed, providing opportunities for housing development that meet the city's housing needs. And so that's about different types of housing. You guys already allow cottage housing, for instance, so we don't need to fuss over that. You'll be required to allow duplexes in more areas. So House Bill 2001 requirements will take care of that, but looking at different housing types. And I think asking yourself, can we imagine in Ashland allowing housing that looks different than what it does in Ashland these days? I think of Ashland as a really attractive community, but when I think about finishes in housing, I think of it as being a granite countertop community rather than something like a Formica countertop. So can you allow some finishes that are less nice In part because finishes are a big part of the cost of development of housing. We asked the same question in Hood River. Hood River is quite a bit like you guys in a lot of different ways. And then you have to have funding sources who pay for your development of infrastructure and affordability. Our committee added on aligning the planning for housing with the Climate and Energy Action Plan. In discussion with staff, we think that's a good idea. Plus, we should look at some other plans that the city has and align planning for housing with those. One example might be your planning for your water and your wastewater and your transportation, making sure that you have infrastructure where you think you're going to see housing development. Because again, vacant land doesn't do you a whole lot of good without infrastructure to allow development. And then another important point was provide informational resources for affordable housing development. So one of the things that we provided you in your packet, and you may not have read because it's really long, but you might decide to read it sometime after this, is a memorandum that starts here on page 12 of your packet that's about example housing strategies and actions. What these are things for you, decision makers in Ashland, to think about. These are best practices. And some of them apply to Ashland and some of them don't apply to Ashland. For instance, I'm looking for something that's really obvious. Maybe you don't need to reduce your street widths. Maybe you've already done that. So skinny streets, not a thing for you. But, you know, looking at everybody's favorite topic, parking requirements, maybe there's some opportunities to consider reduction in parking requirements in specific cases, such as development of affordable housing in an area where you've got transit access, like the transit triangle. I think I'm using the wrong name. So maybe there are some opportunities for that. So this is meant for you guys, for your reading pleasure. It might be more interesting after this conversation. So what I'd like to do, first I'd like to take any questions you have about policies. And then if you're willing to, I'd like to do a round robin where each of you gives a little bit of feedback about what kind of policies you think Ashland really should be looking at. We will incorporate these thoughts into the development of the strategic action plan. So if you had to pick your most important point or two that you don't want us to miss, especially if it's something that nobody else has mentioned, that's what I'm asking for. So does anybody have questions before we do a round robin? Okay, I'm just scribbling everybody's name down so that, because you'll change where you are. Does anybody want to volunteer to go first? Otherwise, I'll call on people. I'm going to call on Jackie because I like her glasses that she just put on.
That's fine. I was just about ready to volunteer. Some of this is kind of depressing for me because I have such a concern about not only the silver, tidal wave that's coming over the hills with the 60 and above, but also people who cannot afford, given what they can make in their work, the amount of money they can make, and then what's affordable. I just don't like the past informing our future here in Ashland. And so I have real concerns about using the past as our future measuring stick of how we're going to do things or what we need to do. So I see a tremendous need for more affordable housing, given the fire issues, given our unhoused community all around us, and being in the group of states on the West Coast that the percentage of unhoused people in those four states is astronomical. So I guess we really need to work on our policies and look at our land and come up with some new models and new ways of doing things to really provide affordable housing.
And Jackie, one, I agree with you, and I agree this is depressing. it is heartbreaking. And Ashland can do things. They may be, you know, small local things, but local is what we can do. So I think there's a certain amount of asking the community to think a little bit differently. I live in Eugene. And let me just say, Eugene is like the center of NIMBYism. You have a lot of people who just don't want to see change, frankly, including my husband and his family. They don't like some of the change. And what you're talking about is inherently change. And so how can we work together as a community is, I think, part of the question the city has to ask itself. So who would like to go next? Otherwise, I'll just start calling on people. I'm going to call on Gina.
Well, thank you so much. I was sitting here and looking at your presentation. Thank you. It was very informative. It was a lot of information to digest. And looking at the easy reading that you mentioned earlier that was in our packet, some of the things that I look forward to the city implementing because of our lack of affordable housing and working with developers, I saw page 25, CET, and how I believe Ashland does not use this. And when I saw that Ashland didn't use it, I thought, why not? I think about the number of people, and I believe you answered this question already about the rent burden that did include a couple of utilities on there, because the utilities in Ashland are going up. And I've had so many people, especially young people, which I agree with Jackie, we don't want our history to dictate our future, is that so many young people can't afford to live here because the rent, do I pay rent or do I pay my utilities? Something's got to give. And to be able to find that balance and to have more affordable housing, whereas we can have it multi-use. So maybe like vertical housing that we are doing at the Transit Triangle, to have more use like that so that we can use our land use wisely and to be able to see how we can perhaps look at the price for building and developing and be able to incentivize our builders and developers to come here and build affordable housing. It's just huge. It's so important. So I really appreciate the slide, but I really appreciated the packet that Linda sent us because it was very informative. So you're just kind of reiterating what was said. So thank you so much.
Certainly. Thank you. So I'm going to call on Rich. Oh no, I've caught you off guard, Rich. I apologize.
Okay, I got it. Well, I just pulled out my headphones. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can, yes.
Yeah, okay. I've read this two or three times, the policy parts of it, and it's very comprehensive. It has everything. And in it, it has a number of points that are just have a small input into how we do housing, and they're fine. But I wanted to just concentrate on two or three things that has a large effect on what we're able to do, kind of building on what Jackie was talking about of the kind of change. And one is the housing trust fund that we have, along with CDBG, is our two sources of incentivizing outside of, we do have the incentivizing that we're doing right now. So many of the things that you recommend we're doing right now, like getting rid of the SDC charges and all those things are good. But if we're gonna jump out, particularly on lower income housing, we're gonna need more funding in the housing trust fund. So where you identify sources of that, I think it's critical. And the one that Medford did, along with eight other cities, is the construction excise tax. And we can do that both on residential housing or commercial housing, but it would represent a real growth in what we can do in a housing trust fund and would give us some pieces of that. So that's one piece. The other part is that we've always had inclusionary zoning, and it's when land comes in from the urban growth boundary or as a zone change. The state would allow us to do urban or inclusionary zoning for the whole city, but it would be at 20 units. But looking at what we're getting now, there's going to be a bunch of those 20 units that are going to be developed in Ashland, and we could get at least a quarter of them to be affordable units where we don't really have to pay much in terms of dollars to incentivize that. So those are the two things, there's others, but those are the two things that I think that we ought to consider.
So I won't discourage you from considering inclusionary zoning. I'll just caution you that it's very complex, and that in some places what they see is more development of 19 unit structures rather than 21 unit structures. So you want to be careful what you disincentivize. So how about we go with Alan next?
Sure. I think for me, it's continuing to do innovative development things at the planning level to open up opportunities. I've really been excited to see the cottage housing development come through Planning Commission in the last 18 months. And it's made me look at lots as inventory. Even just out walking my dog in the morning, I'm like, hey, this could be three cottage units. So that and policies like when we came to Ashland 20 some years ago, you know, you could never put a second kitchen in any part of your house, no matter how big it was. And I think we've really come around to some policies that I think still have a lot of room to run and a lot of room to explore from the development side for being creative. I was not a huge fan of our former mayor, but one of the interesting things he said is we should build up. Someday I want to see eight stories in Ashland. Well, I don't know if that's going to happen. But, you know, Paris was all two stories at one point and that all became eight stories. So I think innovative development opportunities is something we should continue to push ourselves to explore. I don't think you can game the market. I don't think you can pretend to create affordable housing that then becomes market housing in 5 or 10 or 20 years. You just aren't going to game the development market. And, you know, unless Shakespeare never comes back, and then we'll see a great market correction. We'll have a lot of affordable housing is kind of my, so I don't focus on the market force stuff as much as the creative ways to incentivize development that we can do with our code. And the other thing that you've identified that I think has a lot of merit is the development, the funding sources for innovative development and infrastructure. You know, if we as a city can build and fund infrastructure, it's a lot easier to build units that are what our citizens need, because somebody has to pay for all that, and somebody has to pay for the railroad crossing for the normal plan, and somebody has to pay for infrastructure out at Croman Crossing, and you know, that stuff is really going to unlock other value, I think, for us. And I still hope the city will someday explore a funding source for fractional ownership and innovative ways of owning property like a lot of big cities do, where Ashland owns a third of the house. But if you're a firefighter or whoever, or you're somebody who qualifies somehow, you can get in at a much lower price point. It doesn't play with the market value. It plays with the opportunity to purchase and be part of the community at a more affordable rate without trying to game the market. So I think those two things have a lot of real opportunity for us to work on.
Excellent. Thank you, Alan. I'm going to call on Paula next.
Thank you, Beth, for a wonderful presentation. The graphics are excellent. And what strikes me is that the solutions here, I kind of picture a cube, and that you've got like these 6-7 different faces of a cube, and you're trying to understand all these inputs to get to the right place in the middle. And in looking at numbers, the thing I'm most struck by, and I know Alan just touched on this, is the market value of the land. And I think how we can explore economies of scale around a single lot, which would then probably translate to something like height. Again, similar to what Alan was just talking about. Because the one thing that I think will be very difficult for us to impact is that market rate on land. If you looked at the cost of a building here, and then you just take the building itself and move it someplace else, the cost in total clearly would be less someplace else than it is here. So how do we maximize the economy of scale based on the fact that land here just is so expensive, and it's something that we must contend with?
And so I would ask back a question about parking, which when you look, I'm going to quote numbers that are Portland numbers for parking spaces, but when you look at a parking garage above ground, that's typically $45,000 a space. And when you look at that underground parking, that's typically $60,000 a space. And so you can see very quickly how that adds millions of dollars on. And so do you have any thoughts on that?
I would have to defer to the folks on the Planning Commission who have more experience in that area.
Okay. I suspect that one of the more painful things to talk about is going to be parking, but I also think it's an important thing to talk about.
So, thank you.
Certainly. Could I call on Chris next?
So thank you so much for the presentation. There was definitely a lot to digest here, and I will probably be processing this for quite some time. You know, as I'm seeing some of the changes in policies, recommendations, and development, we're talking about land usage and development. I'm just kind of wondering, or maybe one of my concerns is the rent aspect of it. Is, you know, since we have more influence on, you know, land and certain policies and in those areas, when it comes to market, is there policy recommendations that we can be making as far as maybe capping, you know, rent as it continues to incline each year and becomes even more burdensome to our folks in that, you know, income percentile? You know, is there something that we can do to improve and maybe help our renters out when it comes to that influence of market rates and then, you know, seeing this escalation continue over years?
So looking at policies to preserve your existing housing, especially existing naturally occurring affordable housing, I'm honestly not sure how much of that Ashland has. You might have had such an escalation in prices already that there's not a lot of naturally occurring affordable housing, but there may will be some. When you're building new housing, looking at ways to reduce costs, so looking at SDCs, looking at tax exemptions, that kind of thing, and then paying for those things through CET or other ways. But making sure that you've got agreements that housing is going to stay at some level of price. Maybe it's 80% of median family income, or maybe it's lower than that, depending on what it is. But making sure that you've got long-term agreements that keep that housing at that price, so it doesn't immediately escalate. I think it's those kind of things, and you have to look at a bunch of the policies together, because, you know, pulled apart, something like CET isn't all that, well, let's say something like SDC waivers isn't all that interesting without CET to pay for it. or so on and so forth. So I think, Chris, it's going to be a difficult answer, and it's going to be multiple pieces together. So could we go on to Roger?
Sure. Thank you for your presentation. It's great materials. I really thought your presentation, the materials you did on the housing study a couple of years ago, was also very good. And we haven't had action items on it yet, but we're always hopeful. You know, I think we really need to focus on all types of housing, you know, affordable, but certainly also, you know, median income types of housing, you know, that's often the most difficult to get developed, you know, because you can't get, you know, low interest loans for that, and affordable housing developers can't develop that. And as far as strategies, this may be beyond where we're going with this, you know, with this exercise. This may be too down where we get a lot more granular, but our UGB areas, for example, as Alan was saying, some of those areas have real, very costly infrastructure needs. They have problematic access that's going to be expensive to overcome. And they have development patterns that are existing there that are pretty sticky, that are going to be difficult to change. So the low-hanging fruit for us may be, when it comes around to thinking about how to do this, you know, increasing density, doing things like that, increasing density, decreasing parking requirements, increasing lot coverage, things like that in areas that are already developed that could redevelop, like along some of our transit corridors. So I don't know, there's just a, you know, there's a lot of opportunities out there, and I really appreciate we have a lot of we got a lot of good minds in this group, and there are things, you know, we can do. We can't, you know, solve all the housing problems. If it was easy, people would have solved it already. But I think there really are things we can do in the next few years that will help.
Thank you. How about we go to Heidi?
Hi, since I'm on the ad hoc commission committee, I don't want to say too much, but one of the things I really thought about during this presentation is an example I'll give of someone in our neighborhood who was an older woman, an older couple. The husband died, and she converted her single family dwelling, which was quite large, into a duplex. And I could imagine there are so many large single family dwellings in Ashland, and so many people's lives are changing, especially right now, that if we had a public campaign to urge our citizens to consider altering their houses a little bit as they need less space, maybe they could convert part of their house into an apartment for less money. It could benefit everyone. It could offer a lower cost apartment, and it could offer companionship and affordability for people who are widowed. Anyway, that's one thought. I think we need to also urge people to create more ADUs beside their houses or as part of their houses that could be more affordable rental stock. I think we need more tiny house villages, manufactured home options. I think the construction excise tax can be a double-edged sword, but I don't know if we're allowed to target it like a luxury tax. A house over a certain amount of square footage could be charged a construction excise tax. I don't know if that's permitted, but that's one way we might keep from hurting affordable housing construction. And once again, thank you for doing this. Thank you for bringing so many people together. And I really look forward to hearing more ideas about how we can change our community to make it more accessible to more people. Thank you.
How about we go with Haywood? I'm sorry, you're muted, Haywood.
Okay, boy, some of the commissioners laughed because lots of times they wished I was muted. The out-of-town buyer. I have a email here, person's just from a neighbor doing a spec house, just 2 months to completion, already has two offers from out-of-town buyers. We do all these programs to meet all these people. We think we're focusing on the subdivision I live in, probably here has 23 homes, and half of them were cash from California. That you don't know how many are down there, how many more are coming with all it. So we have to realize that, yes, we're going to do some great things here, but some of these things we're doing may be bought out from underneath us by Californians. And going to California and another subject, I came up here 7 years ago, and I still say it, California, any project, condo, apartments, single family, anything over 10 units, you have to have 15% low and moderate income housing, and a lot of jurisdictions have increased that to 20. And here in Oregon, the only thing that's required is in a 20-unit apartment house over one under one ownership, you can require some percentage. The only way Ashland can get the percentage is to annex or, I guess, to do an apartment. So I don't know why all the jurisdictions don't all get on buses and go up to Salem and stand out in front and say, let's do a little more than that apartment house, which gets us 15% of 20 units. Because if you think of all the projects we've had here over 10 units, over the years, or even in the 7 years I've been here, we could have got 15% of those into low and moderate. How many more units that would have brought to all the jurisdictions in Oregon? All I got to say is the realtors and the builders must have one really strong lobby, because this never comes up. And in the Transit Triangle, New Normal, yes, we passed those. There was talk about what we're doing there. We aren't doing anything. Nobody's made any kind of development that we've looked at or that we hope would come to the Transit Triangle or to New Normal. Up here by the railroad tracks, that piece that's along the railroad tracks, that's zoned for multiple family, and there could be a lot of units going in there. Putting in the single family is a lot more difficult because of the land makeup, but nothing's happened. So I think not only looking what we need to do in the future, we need to go back to these areas every now and then and say, wait a minute, we did this 2 years ago. Nothing's happening. Why isn't it? And maybe we could get some clues and it might help us come up with some creative ideas, much like Alan and others have been talking about here. And the last one is parking. Yes, it's a problem, but when you play around with it, it can create problems. And both our cottage units projects had reduced parking requirements. The neighbors in both of them around there went nuts, and they both went to appeal to the city council, which the council approved. But when you start playing around with the standards, yes, they may be necessary. And in the long run, everyone may settle down and agree with them, and you need them to accomplish what you want. But you just got to realize that it might not be an easy road. And I think when I gave my talk to the planning commission, I said, we've looked at the two cottage and we may, depending on what happens with the third one, we may have to go back and look at those standards, which we should do with everything in which we're doing tonight. And that's the way we come up with creative ideas. So I'll push my mute button. Okay.
I appreciate hearing from you, Haywood. So thank you. Could we go with Lita? If I'm saying your name correctly. You're muted also, I'm sorry.
Hi, I'm new,
both here coming to the commission meeting and to Ashland. I'm one of those Californians who did that. We were able to sell and buy here, and I was very involved in various ways in Los Angeles in the homelessness area, and worked for a transitional housing organization, nonprofit. And one of the things that is been a problem there, one of many, is that they don't have that. Well, they theoretically they have a percentage of buildings that must be for affordable housing, but in practicality, it simply doesn't happen. So the developers just come in and do market or over market, and that's it. There's no affordable housing in LA. And here, I mean, it's a problem everywhere. And I do agree that it needs to be a percentage. I wasn't aware that Ashland didn't have something like that. And that is something I feel must happen in order to have affordable housing built, to have it be a required percentage of any building 20 units and more. And more than that, I don't know enough yet about how it works here to have much more of an opinion.
Okay. I appreciate that. How about we go to Linda?
Thank you so much for this presentation. This is amazing. I have so many things to say. I won't try to say them all here, but it sparked so many thoughts in me. First of all, I want to really agree with what Heidi was saying. I feel like there's an opportunity in that seniors living alone, particularly in large homes, are all over Ashland. And particularly, I think as a result of COVID, they have a new understanding of their need to have companionship and people with them. So I think there's an opportunity to divide those into, you know, apartments and duplexes and triplexes out of a large house, or to simply encourage roommates. I've been long attracted to the model that was promoted in the Netherlands, where students are paid to live with seniors, and that they either get free rent or that they get paid to live there in whole communities where that adds to vitality and health of the seniors and the livability for the younger people. It's a very interesting model that isn't being tried much in the United States, I don't think. The other thing that I have been thinking about throughout this presentation is the impact of the fires and the needs that we are exploring as a city around fire safety. And so whether we're talking about expanding the urban growth boundary or infilling within the city, the need for the transportation infrastructure so that our arterials, our exit strategies, our ability to cope with another fire is critical. And I just think it needs to be really included in this thinking as we start thinking about what's ahead. I also have heard a great deal of conversation, and I don't know much about what its possibility or its impact is, but the conversation I just want to drop in here is the possibility of adding a tax on second homes or seasonally vacant homes, which we seem to have quite a few of here in Ashland, and people that are taking up housing space but are really only here for 2 months of the year or 3 months of the year. Is that housing that should have some sort of excise tax on it? So those are my thoughts so far. Thanks.
And on that last piece, I don't know if that's legal in Oregon. I haven't heard that it was, but that doesn't mean that it's not. So I'll ask my colleagues who know more about that kind of thing. So thank you. How about we go with Michael?
Okay. It's sort of interesting listening to the different perspectives here from a 74-year-old native that's watched the town change quite a bit. It was interesting with what Alan had to say with the demise of Shakespeare you know, I lived through the demise of the lumber industry that I grew up with here. And it was interesting that all of a sudden there was all kinds of housing available. And one of the other things that Alan had said was that I've lived in many units after high school that were converted homes that added a kitchen. So I had my own little quarters in, I think, four different houses here. And I think that's one thing that we could explore. It's been touched on a lot. Excuse me. And the one, you know, Jackie reminded me of one of my great theories, which people that know me have to endure, but that the Rogue Valley Manor was the start of the end of affordability in Ashland. And what I mean by that is that all of a sudden, people knew that they did not have to go to Arizona or Florida, you know, to live comfortably because of our climate here. And indeed, when my father started the Oak Knoll development in 1961, the first two phases and the whole development as a whole, as it was supposed to go on, were no kids allowed. In other words, it was adult housing. And so it kind of created this thing that also other people have said, as the watching the money from California coming in and buying houses. And those of us that grew up here, even in the mid-60s, all of a sudden couldn't afford really to buy anything because we're working for the wages here and people could come in. But that's, you know, that's kind of the brief little history of Ashland as I've seen it. And the only policy thing that I really, really like is the construction tax part.
How about Lisa?
Hi there. So I am new to the community. I just moved here in November, and I live in one of the cottage housing developments, which I really like. And I honestly don't know a whole lot about what goes on here and how it goes on and all that. But I'm hoping to learn. I'm on the planning commission, so I'm going to learn. And I don't really have any particular, I read through all the suggestions that you had, and none of them stuck out to me particularly. So I won't endorse any of them right now, but I do think it's a fairly comprehensive list, and I'm very impressed that you could put all those together. And I do see a lot of homeless people walking around town, and I'm sure with COVID-19 there are a lot of people who are just doubling up and tripling up and really having a hard time finding housing, and I'd really like to see if we could do something to alleviate that.
Thank you.
So that's it.
Lynn?
Hi, thank you. A lot has been said here today. You know, I think Ashland has made some steps incrementally in the direction that you're trying to head us. And, you know, there's a lot of things from allowing, you know, in the single family residence zones, ARUs, to now we're going to be allowing duplexes, probably attached and detached, you know, in those zones. You know, there, and we've discussed things like people being able to add second dwelling units inside of single family houses. So I think all of those are all maybe incrementally small, but it would be interesting to me to know, to see them listed really, and an estimate of their impact. You know, how much progress have we made, if any, in all of these little incremental changes that have been adopted over the last 5 years or so. For me, what I get concerned about is a lot of the development that we see at the Planning Commission seems to be small units, you know, because there's this notion that that's what the demand is in Ashland for 1 and 2 person household units. And I worry about trying to bring families in here. And, you know, the response I've gotten is that if we build these small units, then perhaps people will move into the small units and vacate maybe the houses that then families could move into. So maybe there will be some sort of a, you know, an effect there. But I would like to figure out ways that we could actually build, more and affordably, relatively speaking, you know, 2 and 3 bedroom places that people with families would find attractive so we can continue to support the schools here in Ashland. I really worry about that. And I'm worried that that's not the direction we're going, you know, with most of what we're doing. So I don't know what the answer is to that. You know, we had a development on Park Street last year that was actually 4 bedroom units, but the way they were to be marketed was that they were going to be rented out as individual bedrooms. So you would have basically students in them, in effect. So they would all be sharing a kitchen. So there you and rented out at fairly high rents. So not really an affordable option as like a 4-bedroom apartment for somebody, unless you want to spend $4,000 a month on rent. So, you know, that's the kind of large development that we're getting right now, larger unit development. So that's what I think is one of the big challenges as we try to come up with strategies. That's all I've got.
And I'm going to call last but not least on Echo. But we can't hear you, I'm sorry.
There we go. Okay. So I was thinking about processes for community involvement in some of these decisions. So this slideshow is fantastic for that kind of purpose, big chunks of it. So in my past life, I taught a class called Community Studies. And one of the things I talked with students about are different models for doing participatory budget making, participatory decision making. Doing what's called appreciative inquiry. I was looking back at old lecture notes earlier. So there are lots of different models for doing that, where you get people usually physically in a room or maybe on Zoom. You present exactly this sort of information, and then you get people into breakout sessions and get them to talk about exactly what we've just done here today. And that's one way to get around the NIMBYism problem. The trick with this is that you've got to get more than the usual suspects. And that means you've got to get more than people over 60. So that means you have to take these kinds of events into unconventional places, out to the street, into the park, into student family housing at SOU, those kinds of settings where you get really a much more diverse, set of participants. So I would like to see that happen around these issues. And I have more to say, but that'll do.
So one, I couldn't have paid you to tee up our next topic better. And two, I really like your cat.
Yeah, it's my coworker.
And I've got a few of those. I watched when I was working on this sort of project with Tualatin, up in the Portland area. They did a fantastic job of trying to get broader participation, not just from younger people under 60, but also from the Latinx community. Mm-hmm. And it took them a lot of work, but part of what we did is we went out into the park a few times, and they had concert in the park, just some people playing music and that kind of thing. And we set up our little come give us opinions and talk to us stations. And that was moderately effective. And I think a lot more cities are looking at those kind of things. So then the next topic of conversation unless anybody has anything else they want to talk about, is in fact about an open house for this project. Heywood, are you waving to me?
One more quick thing on Ashland, what they can do to require affordable that I missed. They do have a present bonus program. You can't require development, but if the developer wants to do certain things, he gets a bonus, and there is affordable units that are done. And so that does work sometimes. And I think as the ad hoc committee and everyone goes together, works on it before it comes back, and it's in the list of strategies, can be looked at really to see how it might be tweaked or work better. But that's one I missed, and it has been used, and I think it's a good tool. So that's all.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other comments that we missed? Okay. So then we're going to be doing some community engagement. It's going to be an online open house. What we're talking about right now is a little different than a Zoom meeting. I think that a lot of people are Zoomed out a little bit. And I'm going to show you an example of what we're talking about, which is from, it's not from a housing project, but it was from an economic opportunities project, which is similar, but about, you know, economic development instead, from the city of Dallas. So this is a way that you can have a lot of pictures, present some information, some of which hopefully is at least marginally interesting. You can show the evil ball of doom that I hope never to have to show after this year again. So here we've got information, blah, 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 information, commuting. And then you can also include survey as part of this. And you can do surveys of different types. This is just a Likert sort of survey about, do you like this? Do you not like this? That kind of thing. And this is something that we can leave up for, we're talking about for 2 weeks, and let people walk through at their leisure. And it would have pictures specifically of Ashland in it. And it's meant to be visually appealing, as well as providing some information of the type that we've shown here. But we want to be careful how much information. We don't need to overload our participants. And it's more important to get them to answer different questions for us. So that's what we're thinking currently. Do you have any particular thoughts about the community engagement, about specific things that you're hoping we'll ask or include? Yes, please, Jackie.
Well, I also have a concern about keeping our community healthy and balanced with attracting more families and that will be attending our schools and sort of, you know, keeping that balance from the senior citizens and the people from California to, you know, the people that are going to add so much vitality to our community. So when you do a survey like this, I would just want to know how could we, maybe we could include somehow the school board and the PTAs and the school organizations to get more families to give us ideas moving forward.
And so you've hit on a key piece of this. If the city, and I'll say the city includes all of you, doesn't do anything to promote this, then this would be the most boring survey in the world. We'd get maybe 20 responses if we were lucky. But if the city promotes it, and if you all send it out to the people who you know, who you're hoping that would respond, so if somebody has a connection, say, with the school district, and we could get it out to the PTA relatively early, and whatever other organizations are important, then you can get a much better response in something like this. And frankly, you can get a bigger response if less detailed feedback than you can in most public meetings. That plays to your advantage right now, because what you'll be doing is with this housing strategy, you'll be throwing out a bunch of ideas. And in your housing production strategy, one would imagine you'll be narrowing down those ideas and refining them and probably adding a few things to them that we've missed. And that will require some public discussion with it. And then implementing that housing strategy, we're talking about a lot of work for city staff. So I don't think your staff will get bored of this anytime soon. They'd have a lot to do, but there's a lot of on each of these things. Something like developing a CET, you need a lot of input from your developer community, and you need buy-in from your developer community in order for something like that to work. What if Ashlyn was thinking really big and thought about a general obligation bond? Portland and Metro have issued some general obligation bonds recently for building subsidized affordable housing. Ashlyn could do that if the community got behind it. That's something that would have to go to a vote, and so the most intense of public involvement. So I think at all these different levels, and you guys will help us get better response if you're able to help us by sending it out to people you hope to fill it in.
And I would add to that, if individuals have, Rich has a comment on that, but if individuals know particular constituencies, groups to forward it to, I've heard a couple tonight in terms of SOU student housing, reach out through them, and also the school board. We're fortunate to have a school board member on the advisory group for this project. So we'll rely on him to make those connections as well. But if anybody else has particular groups that you'd like the survey to be sent to, forward those to me, and I'll make sure that they're copied on correspondence and are aware of when it's posted. So Rich was waving his hand when I interjected.
No, that's all right. I was after you. I've been part of the CCO movement, Coordinated Care Organizations, and they have very complicated healthcare policies that they need to get input from. And so I really like the targeting. In some cases, we use focus groups within targeted groups, and it really was very effective in hearing from them about what they were onto. The second thing that I'm really interested in with the coordinated care organizations is ordinary language. So I saw one set of policies that someone presented to us, and it was totally unintelligible completely. And there is a ordinary language movement that we can take these same things and put them in a way that reaches out in different ways to people. So I'd like to see two of those things happen.
Thank you, Rich. It's always a good reminder to step out of my planner brain into my normal person brain.
Right.
And I would also say that there are some things that are too complex to ask about in a survey. Something like urban renewal, for instance. It's a very complex topic. If the city wants input on something like that, then I suggest in-person meeting where you're actually talking about it and you can explain the benefits and the drawbacks of it, because it has both. So I think asking questions that normal people, which I would say the people in this room, our virtual room here, may not be quite normal people, can have opinions about, I think is an important thing to consider. Are there any other comments?
I would like to make one.
Yes, please.
This is, again, an observation in that, it keeps coming up with wanting to bring more children into the town and be part of our school systems, which, again, obviously I would totally entertain. But my observation is when you go to places like in the kind of the north end of Medford, where Hayden Homes, like locusts, have gone over the land 10 units per acre. And the question becomes, and I think even part of a survey question, if you could, make wordsmith it enough, is that people are going there because they can have their own little house and own little yard. And the housing costs there, because they're on old orchards, are the land costs are so considerably less than they are here. So what could we do to make that sort of person that wants to go live in that want to come live, like you said, Beth, that you grew up, you know, in townhouses, that sort of thing? What could we do to make that more attractive, that people would start to come here and sacrifice the need for, you know, for me, the hideous houses that they have there?
Those are some interesting questions, and I think we'll think about that a little bit. I don't want to overpromise, though. And I'll also mention that cities have different roles in a region. I've done a fair bit of work for Talent a few years ago in Phoenix, and I'm doing some work for Medford right now. So yeah. Are there any other comments? Roger has his hand up, but he's muted.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning the development community, because we can have all the great ideas in the world, but unless somebody's willing to build it, we're not going to be very effective. So reaching out to all kinds of sectors in the development community has been very helpful in the past, and staff has been very good about it here. So thanks for mentioning that.
Certainly. And what I'm hoping happens a little bit more, I'm hoping this for all of Oregon, but especially more urban areas like Jackson County and, you know, Lane County, et cetera, is that as these middle income housing types become more common, they become a little more accepted in our communities, and the builders have more experience in financing. There's more sources of financing for them. They know how to build them more. And that's something that's probably a decade long wish of mine. Perhaps that helps some of this over time. So are there any other comments? So I want to thank you all. It's not your job to make my job easier, but you've just made my job a lot easier when I put together the comments we had here and the comments we have from our committee. Writing the draft housing strategy is going to be a lot easier because I know what you all are interested in, and there'll only be so much of guessing of me saying, let me throw this in and see if it's interesting. Because I believe in asking the questions, even if it's not the right answer for the community. So thank you all.
Yeah. And I'd like to thank everybody as well, and also note that this project is not completed. It's going to be coming back to each of your commissions at study sessions in March, and I've put information in the chat. And also the public open house, as we mentioned, once we get that formulated, we'll run that past the Housing Capacity Advisory Group and then post that. And obviously you'll get results from that survey as well as part of your decision making. Ultimately, when this project is completed, at this stage, it goes to the City Council at a study session. And at that point, Eco Northwest's work is done. And then it's on the city to adopt a final plan. And so that's the adoption of the final housing capacity analysis. Will be informed by all the work that you guys are doing at these study sessions, as well as the open house that we do. And the final document will be presented probably in July or August of 2021 to the City Council for approval and adoption. It's our hope that going through these study sessions, everybody's up to speed on it, and you have ample opportunities to ask questions. And clearly, if you have any questions, now that you've had, I think, a 28-page document of policies to look at that come after this meeting, feel free to shoot me those questions. We'll see if we can't get answers back to you. And again, we're open to all communication between now and when we move on to the housing production strategy. So I look forward to hearing from you guys all again. So with that, unless there's anything else for the good of the order, Rich can adjourn the meeting and we can get dinner.
Well, thanks everybody, and enjoy a nice dinner and stay warm.
You too.